in the last episode of Wildlife Kingpin.
So we had a Bert, an Ernie, an Elmo, a Grover, an Oscar. We actually ran out of Sesame Street characters, so we moved to the Muppets.
That were using a hairdryer, blow dryer, to blow dry the horns. They were very fresh after the rhinos were killed.
We found that in Vietnam, that the environmental police were fantastic when we could put product in a room.
They put together a team to come and conduct the raid.
So in 2017, the law in Vietnam changed, which meant the products like ivory and rhino horn now carried a much heavier sentence.
76 horns was not something that I ever anticipated seeing in the one image.
From the Wildlife Justice Commission, this is Wildlife Kingpin, the rise and fall of Arnhem. Episode 3. It's a late night on a cool evening in Hanoi. Sitting outside a cafe next to a mid-sized shopping mall, four men sit around a table. Their conversation is animated. After about 30 minutes of negotiating and several heated phone calls, two of the men agree to go for a drive. The other two will remain behind and wait at the cafe. The two men that decide to leave get into a black Toyota Land Cruiser, drive out of the car park and up a ramp and onto the expressway. The driver of the Land Cruiser is Ar Nam, aka Bert, by now a confirmed major wildlife trafficker operating out of Vietnam. And the passenger next to him is an undercover agent working for the Wildlife Justice Commission. Their destination? A small village just out of Hanoi that is storing 1 ton of raw African elephant ivory.
They reached an agreement, and by this time it was very late. The coffee shops were closing. It must have been certainly after 10 at night.
This is Dave, a former British police officer working as an investigator with the Wildlife Justice Commission.
They reached an agreement that they would take one of our operatives to go and see the goods and put our operative in a car. We were happy with that. We had control over the operative, where we knew where they were. So we were able to follow the car to a village.
I was in the surveillance team to cover them, to make sure that everything was safe with the undercover operative. It was a very intense night.
This is an undercover field operative working for the Wildlife Justice Commission. We'll call her Sally, which is not her real name, as the nature of her work requires her identity to be protected.
When they were in the coffee shop within that shopping center, he left one UC back at the coffee shop, and he took the other to his warehouse to see the products. But we have a cover team, surveillance team, to go with Annam and the UC about 20 kilometers away of Hanoi City.
And then just outside the village, they swapped cars, the operative was put into a smaller car, driven through the country lanes, through the little tracks in the, between the farms, very close to Nike village.
As the cover team moved through the dead of night, inside the warehouse, the undercover agent was introduced to the owner of the house, who took them up to the first floor, stacked to one side in neat rows. And taking up almost half the room were large cut ivory tusks. The owner of the house took numerous photos of the ivory product before sending them to Ar Nam, who was waiting down the road. No other pictures or phones were allowed at this sighting. Such was the paranoia of the traffickers. After the sighting, Ar Nam spoke to the undercover operative in the vehicle. He seemed relaxed and very happy that the sighting had progressed well. He even started boasting about his connections with a high-profile trader from Malaysia.
After seeing the products and go back to the coffee shop and meeting the other undercover operative, and the meeting was finished and we go back to brief with the team, and he told us everything about the location that he could remember and the details of the house in that village.
So the operative literally had to retrace his footsteps, and he remembered, he did a cracking job, remembered certain landmarks, certain things that were on this route which was otherwise barren.
Following this successful deployment, the WJC investigators were able to pin down the exact premises located within a village called Kung Ha that was next to the notorious hub of Nikkei.
The operative was able to remember very minute details about landmarks, going through an archway, markings on a door, the colour of the door and something in the window, that sort of thing, which enabled us to pinpoint the address where this stuff was. And it was a ton, you know, it's not the sort of thing, you can't take it out the back door in the back of a rucksack. So we knew if it was there that night, it was very likely to be there the following day.
The Vietnamese Environmental Police, working directly with the Wildlife Justice Commission, conducted a raid at the house and seized 971 kilograms of African elephant ivory and arrested four individuals, including the person who had photographed the products and sent them to Arnhem. However, once again, Arnhem was not charged for his part in this bust, despite being the owner of approximately half of the seized ivory.
So the seizure of one tonne of ivory in Kung Ha was, you know, also a fantastic moment in the investigation. It took a lot of work to get to there, obviously, and it was a little bit disappointing that Arnhem wasn't in the room when the arrest was taken down.
Steve Carmody is the Director of Programs at the Wildlife Justice Commission and a former Australian police officer with over 30 years' experience.
Yeah, we have to make several considerations before we share intelligence or evidence with law enforcement agencies. Often, you know, we don't want to disclose methodology or the identity of our undercover operative. That's changed since Arnhem to a certain extent, in that we are now working very closely with law enforcement, and often our undercover operatives act as agents of law enforcement and if necessary will testify. But, you know, you have to, in some countries, you have to sanitise the information to try to protect the identity of the source or the methodologies we used, the entry points we used to find that information. And, you know, and often until you develop a rapport with law enforcement, it's a bit of a chess game, you know, filling each other out. You know, I would rather give information to law enforcement and have that operation compromised than hold something back that they need to action that information out of fear of not trusting them. I'd rather share it, and if they burn us, well, that's, you know, that's the way it is, but at least then we will know. Whereas if you hold stuff back and you don't share enough, you can't turn around and blame the law enforcement agency for not taking action if there's not enough evidence there or information there to enable them, you know, to get a warrant or to arrest someone.
By mid to late 2018, Arnhem was continuing to meet more clients, yet keep himself from being hands-on with the wildlife products. Using the intelligence that was collected through numerous sources, the Wildlife Justice Commission's Intelligence Development Unit was able to not just map Arnhem's network, but also the supply chain between other wildlife trafficking networks, both in Vietnam and overseas.
Intelligence can be a force multiplier because it can help you figure out where you should be focusing your resources rather than just doing a sort of scattershot.
Olivia Swart-Goldman, a lawyer formerly working at the International Criminal Court, is the Executive Director at the Wildlife Justice Commission.
Intelligence and the IDU is really important for investigative activities. It's also increasingly important for us to create a global picture of what's happening in wildlife crime. And we need that picture to understand what's going on and ideally to be a step ahead of the criminals.
So our intelligence analyst estimated that during the three-year investigation that NAM had access to around 17 tons of raw ivory and around 500 kilos of rhino horn.
Sarah Stoner is the Director of Intelligence at the Wildlife Justice Commission and is a former police analyst with over a decade working on wildlife crime.
So both of these commodities have an estimated combined street value of around $17 million. And this was actually only based upon what we were able to observe and quantify, so in reality the figure could actually be much higher.
Well, he certainly is wealthy. He has a few cars. He changed cars every few months. He used to live in a pretty luxury apartment. And then after that, he changed into a big house. It's a pretty luxury lifestyle he has. So I think he made pretty good profit in this business.
Fak Nam was making so much money that he was struggling to find ways to launder it. We know also that he was investing in property and even getting his associates to invest in business so that it seemed more legitimate. The investigation also found that his wife was very much involved and she was actually responsible for handling the legitimate business affairs.
The unarmed case really was an opportunity for the Vietnamese to follow the money. He liked to live the high life, and he liked to show that, and his wife liked to show that, and he had no obvious means of income. He sat in the same coffee shops, meeting with Chinese buyers. You know, we never followed him to a workplace where he appeared to do a traditional job. His wife was into real estate, but there was no indication that she was making the sort of money that could have funded their lifestyle. So it was an opportunity missed not to go after the money there.
On the 13th of August, 2018, Malaysian authorities seized a consignment of 50 rhino horns weighing 116 kilograms and an assortment of lion bones. They had been sent from Africa and were destined for Vietnam. And while the international press and enforcement agencies around the world were trying to make sense of one of the largest seizures of rhino horn outside of Africa, the Wildlife Justice Commission were already monitoring the people responsible.
So yeah, the major rhino horn seizure in Malaysia was really a pivotal moment for the investigation. At that point in time, we confirmed where Arnam sat in the structure. He was right up the top. That rhino horn was in a container, an air freight container with lion bones, and the lion bones hadn't been cleaned properly and the smell attracted attention at the airport. Now, at that point in time, we were talking to a suspect in South Africa, a Vietnamese suspect that was involved in trafficking rhino horn, who discussed this seizure with us and told us that he'd packed the lion bones into the container and had actually said that these things smell. Now, at the time, we had several undercover operatives into Arnam and also one into the Malaysian connection.
This Malaysian connection was the same person who Arnam was boasting about to the undercover operative that night he showed them the 1 ton of ivory. Arnam, the Malaysian connection, and four other people were gathered at a premises in Hanoi for the purpose of discussing this latest hit the group had taken in Malaysia.
Now, we'd been informed by the Malaysian connection that the rhino horn had been seized and that he had to go to Vietnam to speak to the owners. Now, we managed to pick up the Malaysian connection at the airport and we took him to a meeting with Arnam, also with a gentleman who arrived in a Land Cruiser with Cambodian diplomatic plates, and a number of Chinese guys and a woman. They'd moved into a bar at a backpacker's hostel where they proceeded to sit for the next hour and discuss trying to buy back the container and if that didn't work, how they would pay Mr. Chen, the boss from China.
Over the course of 2 days, the Wildlife Justice Commission were able to monitor the conversations of this group as they desperately tried to come up with a solution on how to retrieve the 116 kilograms of rhino horn.
So the seizure initially started, I believe, with quarantine people at KLIA, and then it went to Pahilatan, the local wildlife agency there in Malaysia. Now, that was probably a stroke of luck, because if it had gone to customs, the Malaysian connection was very, very well connected at Malaysian customs, and he continued to tell us that. So if it had gone to customs first, there was a very good chance that they would have actually been able to cover up that seizure. Well, the Malaysian connection is fairly well known. We can't discuss his name, you know, because he's has several matters before the court and we don't want to influence any court decision. So,
while no one was able to be arrested for that seizure, the meeting itself confirmed that Arnam was no longer a small-time broker and instead had a seat at the table working side by side with one of the world's biggest transporters of illegal wildlife products. By 2019, the rhino horn trade was not only thriving, but seizures in Africa and overseas were increasing in volume compared to previous years. This trend suggested to wildlife investigators that the traffickers were changing their approach. Not only that, the consignments of rhino horn included cut horns that would typically be stockpiled at farms where rhinos had been dehorned for their own safety.
You know, the quantity that these guys could move was mind-blowing, but not only that, the speed at which it moved and the frequency of which it moved.
he shared pictures of piles and piles, according to him, close to 20 tons of ivory stored near the Cambodian border, and invited me or my representative to visit for the sighting and viewing of the ivory.
This is Jimmy, not his real name. He's an undercover operative working with the Wildlife Justice Commission.
He wasn't able to bring my representative directly to view the products, but instead he will probably use one objective that my representative would always use, for example, his phone, and take it to the where the products are stored and take a picture of the products with that phone to prove that he has direct access to these products and to show the quality of these products.
If you give me your mobile phone, he said, I'll take your mobile phone and I will video the ivory so that you can see on your mobile phone that it is here. That will be proof that, the ivory is here, and it's, you know, it's very local. It's somewhere nearby.
As agreed, the Wildlife Justice Commission operatives met with Arnhem and provided him with a mobile phone for the purpose of taking images of the stored ivory. To their disappointment, but not their surprise, Arnhem ensured that the handset was turned off straight after he had received it. The following morning, Arnhem sent the operatives a video of a stack of ivory with a piece of paper that showed the date placed on top, right next to the very same phone given to Arnhem by the operatives.
And you can also see the flip-flops of the guy that was taking the video. He was very careful not to get anyone's faces in it, but you could see his flip-flops in it. And the other thing I remember on the video, you could hear there was music playing. There was a Vietnamese music playing. You could just hear it in the background.
In the midday hustle and bustle of Hanoi, Arnhem was making his way from his usual haunts to meet with the undercover operatives to return the phone seen in the ivory video.
At the same time, we have a surveillance team on him to find out how he's getting these photos and videos to show our undercover operatives. And we were following his car from his house. And then he suddenly make a right, and then he had stopped. When his car was stopped, a woman was riding a bike and approached him. Me and my colleague think something was happening here because he was supposed to go into the meeting to meet our undercover operatives, and he's going to hand over the phone to them. And then we saw the lady gave the phone for him. So we make the decision that we're gonna follow the lady.
While Arnhem drove into central Hanoi to meet the undercover operatives and hand back the phone, the Wildlife Justice Commission street team followed this unknown lady on a scooter to a nearby location.
And when we followed her to a rice shop which she owned, we went into the shop and we talked and pretend to be customers of the shop.
And then I get communication from our surveillance that's in the coffee shop. Managed to record a conversation that this female has with a colleague of hers in the coffee shop, in which she talks about just going to meet the guy and hand the phone back. And she was saying, I don't really trust this guy, you know, I want to see the money first.
We look around and we see the patterns of the details of the house. And also we see one flip-flop that was shown in the video that he sent to us with the product.
The other thing we noticed by looking at the video was the floor tiles were the same, and it was the same song playing on the video from our footman in the coffee shop as could be heard on the video of the ivory. So we were 100% happy that we had the location of the ivory.
With enough evidence that the premises contained ivory, the Vietnamese Environmental Police once more conducted a raid on the rice shop, seizing 207 kilograms of elephant ivory and arresting three suspects. While Arnhem once again escaped the police net, his reputation had taken another hit.
I think after that, her reputation was a little bit down. So probably after that, people think that if you do work with Arnim, some bad luck is going to happen.
Despite Arnim evading capture once again, the Wildlife Justice Commission remained on his tail. However, they weren't the only ones.
So the Vietnamese cops were, you know, they were really itching to pin him to a case. And so I guess they started to look at international partners and how they can build a strong case against him. You know, he'd been on the fringes of all these cases over the years, and he'd worked his way up from, you know, a street level broker to a prominent international trader.
I remember we were still talking about ivory and rhino horn or pangolin as usual. He responded that he was very busy at that time, which happened quite often with Anand, because he just generally had a lot of customers to take care of, and he promised me to come back to me in a couple of days. But he didn't come back to me with anything 2 days later. So I went back to him with another message asking for updates. And he replies with a message saying that he has some issues at the moment. He's probably going to be away for 5 days, and he will come back to talk to me about more details of the products that I wanted at the time 5 days later. And 5 days later, his phone was completely shut. He was nowhere to be found and reached.
After several years and countless deals, justice finally caught up with Arnim and his sidekick, Afung. At the time that Arnim was conversing with Jimmy, Arnim and Afung met with a Chinese buyer and Vietnamese translator in Hanoi on a deal for 204 kilograms of ivory. However, the deal was a sting operation, and Arnim, Afung, and a cousin of Arnim, who was transporting the ivory as a driver, were all arrested. Arnim and Afung were both found guilty, and in July 2020, they were sentenced to 11 years imprisonment. The boom in wildlife products during the last decade has shown to what lengths criminals will try to profit from the death of animals and the people sworn to protect them. And for a trader like Arnim, it's proof that wildlife crime still remains a very profitable business, enough to take a small-time broker to the top of the supply chain, albeit for a very short time.
You know, the final arrest of Arnim was fantastic. It brought him to justice. Unfortunately, it was for only 200 odd kilos of ivory. And whilst he was given a significant sentence, that sentence still didn't represent his true involvement in wildlife crime in Vietnam.
During the three-year investigation, we observed him start as a mid-level broker and actually rise to become one of Vietnam's most significant wildlife criminals. And actually, he's a perfect example of how enormously profitable wildlife crime can be, especially on the wholesale end of the supply chain.
The Vietnamese are getting more and more aware of the important role in Vietnam in the wildlife trading. And for the past few years, we cut up many seizures and many arrests have been made.
There still are a lot of Vietnamese and Chinese criminals organizing the sourcing, transporting, and at the end markets globally. But I can also see there have been a lot of positive changes, particularly in China, strengthened law enforcement activities, as well as the progress in the legislations. And I just hope that these changes are fast enough in comparison with the animals that we're losing in Africa.
Yeah, I suppose you can liken the law enforcement response to wildlife trafficking to a game of chess. So historically, we've seen law enforcement just picking off pawns here and there, you know, by arresting couriers as they pass through airports carrying goods on behalf of their paymasters. But I mean, that's a short-term win, really. I think what we need to be doing in future is looking at a longer-term strategy, targeting the bigger pieces like the rooks, the knights, and the bishops that are controlling the middle of the board. only that way are we going to have any chance of getting into a game-winning position.
The WJC is growing, and it's incredibly exciting to be part of that and to see it. We've been really, really effective in a number of countries, and our goal is to really work with these countries to make sure that they have the capacity and political willingness to continue to keep the pressure on these transnational organized criminal groups. So we are in for the long term. We're willing to work with governments and help them to build up these skills and their intelligence capacity and their investigative capacity and their political will to be bringing these cases.
You know, for me, one of the most frustrating things of all is that having worked in drug law enforcement and organized crime law enforcement, I see the resources that are available to law enforcement agencies and the skill sets that exist within law enforcement. And it's just not being applied enough to address this. At the end of the day, you know, we're guardians of the world's heritage for our children and our children's children. And at the moment, we're doing a pretty piss poor effort. Now, at the moment, we're not losing anymore, I don't think, but we're not winning yet, you know. And to win, we really need to focus our resources and our expertise. Wildlife crime is not going to be stopped by policing or law enforcement on its own. Demand reduction, working with communities, diverting suspects away into other areas are all crucial tools that are needed to address this issue. But at the moment, we're not seeing the true capabilities of law enforcement to address this issue.
This was the third and final episode of Wildlife Kingpin, The Rise and Fall of Arnhem. If you want to learn more about this investigation into Arnhem, you can visit the Wildlife Justice Commission website at wildlifejustice.org and download the full report, Arnhem, The Downfall of Vietnam's Wolf of Wall Street. You can also read a new Rhino report published on the Wildlife Justice Commission website that details in-depth analysis and findings from multiple investigations conducted on rhino trafficking networks operating between Africa and Asia. Wildlife Kingpin is an original podcast series brought to you by the Wildlife Justice Commission. Be sure to subscribe to this channel on iTunes, Spotify, and SoundCloud, and look out for future series or new content. If you enjoyed this series, please share it with your friends, family, and wider network. And if possible, give us a review. Music in this episode is from Kevin MacLeod and sourced from incompetech.com. You can learn more about the work of the Wildlife Justice Commission at their website or by following the organisation on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook.